This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 17th, 2010. In New York, I'm Doran Marina. Coming up on today's newscast,
should there be a ban on companies that have miserable safety and environmental records?
In the 3 years that I've been CEO, I've focused on improving dramatically our safety and environmental performance.
BP's CEO comes under fire from a congressional panel over his company's handling of the Gulf oil disaster.
Your safety record, you have 26 people dead, more than 170 injured. You have the largest spill ever in Alaska. You now have the largest environmental disaster that hit the United States.
The Senate takes up the U.S.-Russia nuclear arms treaty. And we'll go to California, where lawyers gave closing arguments in the state's landmark Proposition 8 trial on same-sex marriage.
No vote can take away a constitutional right. That is why we have a constitution.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. U.S. Peace Envoy George Mitchell is back in the Middle East today trying to restart talks between Israel and the Palestinians. Indirect negotiations have been all but halted since Israel's attack on the Gaza aid flotilla. But in what could be a softening of position, Israel's cabinet decided today to ease the overland Gaza blockade significantly. FSRN's Rami Almagari has the reaction from Gaza.
The decision allows a list of items into Gaza that have been banned by Israel since 2007. The new list includes all food items, toys, stationery, kitchen utensils, mattresses and towels, according to Raed Fattouh, the Palestinian Authority official who coordinates entry of goods into Gaza. Yet Israel says it will continue to prevent entry of many other items, including construction materials like cement and steel, except when needed for vital UN projects. Also, Israel will maintain the blockade on ships entering Gaza ports and continue to restrict the movement of residents at land crossings. Fattouh says Israel needs to go even further in easing the blockade.
We consider this a positive step, yet it is not enough. We call on the Israeli side to allow entry of all 4,000 goods that used to enter the territory before the siege was imposed.
The ruling Hamas party in Gaza says the goods allowed to enter are secondary and trivial. The party demands a complete lifting of the blockade to allow unrestricted movement of people and goods alike. Rami Almighari, FSRN, Gaza.
Also in Israel today, an estimated 80,000 people took to the streets in Jerusalem to protest a high court decision to imprison a group of parents of European origin who refused to send their children to school with Jews of Middle Eastern descent. The ultra-Orthodox parents say the schools in question are not religious enough. According to AFP, both sides are protesting the intervention of the state into what they see as a religious matter. In a year that has been marked by several mining accidents, including disasters in China and West Virginia, a new explosion at a Colombian coal mine has killed at least 16 people. Authorities in the South American country are expecting more casualties as rescue workers search for more than 60 others who are trapped in the mine. FSRN's Manuel Rueda has more from Bogota.
Colombia's Geological Institute says the explosion at the San Fernando coal mine occurred around 10:30 p.m. last night and was sparked by methane gas. Records indicate that 72 workers were inside the mine at the time. Rescue teams are working around the clock and so far have not found any survivors. John Freddy Rendon directs rescue efforts at the mine. He says the chances of finding any survivors are slim.
The explosion was so great that we felt it at the surface, even though it occurred some 6,000 feet underground. The depth of this explosion, the lack of oxygen, and the accumulation of gases makes us fear for the lives of those who are inside the mine.
The accident occurred at a domestically owned mine near the town of Amaga in the northwest part of the country. Last year, 9 miners died in another coal mining accident in the same region. Manuel Rueda, FSRN, Bogota.
A U.S. lawyer arrested for genocide denial in Rwanda has been released from jail on medical bail. Minnesota resident Peter Erlander traveled to the Central African country last month to defend a Rwandan opposition leader in court. Authorities arrested him soon after his arrival. Erlander's lawyer told the AP that Erlander was free to go home on condition that he meet certain criteria of the court. The case raises questions of the scope of freedom of expression in the country. A human rights group is accusing Kenyan police of abusing refugees and asylum seekers fleeing war-torn Somalia. For FSRN, Abdul Karim Jamale reports from Nairobi.
The new Human Rights Watch report is entitled Welcome to Kenya, Police Abuse of Somali Refugees. It says that Somalis who cross into Kenya, most of whom are women and children, are being subjected to widespread mistreatment. Reporter Jerry Simpson spoke at a press conference today in Nairobi.
There is excessive use of force by the police, resulting in death and miscarriages of pregnant women, rape and other forms of physical violence, including whipping, kicking and beating, widespread unlawful forced return to war-torn Somalia in contravention of refugee law, and systematic unlawful arrest and detention in inhuman and degrading conditions in a number of police stations, and widespread extortion.
Human Rights Watch is appealing to the Kenyan government to rein in its police and to the United Nations to improve its monitoring of the situation. Kenya's government officially closed its 682-kilometer border with Somalia in January 2007 after clashes erupted between radical Islamists and Somali government troops. Kenya's Dadaab refugee camp houses nearly 300,000 Somali refugees, yet it was only built to house 90,000 people. Abdul Karim Jimale, FSRN, Nairobi.
And finally, the UN has postponed awarding an International Education Prize for work in life sciences after receiving criticism about its name and origin. The UNESCO Obiang Nguema Mbasogo International Prize for Research in the Life Sciences is funded by and named for Equatorial Guinea's dictator, Teodoro Obiang Nguema. The longtime dictator is widely criticized for corruption and human rights violations. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
This is Dorian Marina in New York. Today, BP CEO Tony Hayward came before a congressional panel to defend his company's safety performance and response to the Gulf oil spill. Lawmakers took the chance to press him on his company's poor safety record, saying cost-cutting may have led to greater risks. Tanya Snyder reports.
Tony Hayward opened with an apology.
The explosion and fire aboard the Deepwater Horizon and the resulting oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico never should have happened. And I'm deeply sorry that it did.
Hayward wasn't the only one to issue an apology. The top Republican on the Energy and Commerce Committee, Joe Barton of Texas, apologized to Hayward for the actions of the Obama administration, specifically the agreement Hayward reached with President Obama Wednesday to establish a $20 billion compensation fund for the victims of the spill.
Now, I'm ashamed of what happened in the White House yesterday. I think it is a tragedy of the first proportion that a private corporation can be subjected to what I would characterize as a shakedown, in this case a $20 billion shakedown.
Other top House Republicans quickly distanced themselves from Barton's remark. Minority Leader John Boehner said he's glad BP has accepted responsibility for their actions and welcomes the decision to open an escrow account for damages. Meanwhile, other Republicans focused their ire on the government officials who let BP get away with poor safety performance. The investigation into BP's actions has turned up new evidence of the corporate culture that allowed the spill to happen. Democrat Henry Waxman, who chairs the full Energy and Commerce Committee, railed against what he calls BP's corporate complacency.
A drilling engineer for the rig, called Macondo, a nightmare well. Other BP employees predicted that the cement job would fail. Halliburton warned of a severe gas flow problem. These warnings fell on deaf ears.
Waxman said BP's attitude towards safety is best illuminated by this email from a BP official who oversaw the team of drilling engineers.
After learning of the risks and BP's decision to ignore them, he wrote, quote, "Who cares? It's done. End of story. we'll probably be fine, end quote.
Even faced with observations like these, Hayward spent much of the hearing asserting that BP has made major changes to prioritize safety. Here he answers ferocious questioning by Subcommittee Chair Bart Stupak.
Your safety record, you have 26 people dead, more than 170 injured. You have the largest spill ever in Alaska. You now have the largest environmental disaster that hit the United States with no end in sight with this disaster. Do you believe the U.S. government should continue to allow companies that have poor safety records, poor environmental records, to explore minerals or oil exploration in our country? Should there be a ban on companies that have miserable safety and environmental records?
In the 3 years that I've been CEO, I've focused on improving dramatically our safety and environmental performance.
Stupak and Waxman sent Hayward a letter a few days before his testimony asking him about five decisions made by BP, which they say led to the disaster. They mention well design that other oil and gas companies say they wouldn't have used, as well as inadequate evaluation of the safety of the cement. Hayward repeatedly refused to respond to questions about safety decisions.
I'm not prepared to draw conclusions about this accident until such time as the investigation has concluded.
Well, this is an investigation. That's what this committee is doing. It's an investigatory committee.
Democrat Henry Waxman.
And we expect you to cooperate with us. Are you failing to cooperate with other investigators as well? Because they're going to have a hard time reaching conclusions if you stonewall them.
But the stonewalling is understandable when you realize what an impossible spot Hayward finds himself in. Code Pink founder Medea Benjamin says it's a no-win situation for BP.
Rationally, he's over a barrel in this one. And that if he says it was a mistake, then they're negligent and they're liable for, you know, all kinds of claims. And if they say this is offshore drilling, then yes, we should stop offshore drilling.
Another Code Pink activist, Diane Wilson, stood up as Hayward began his testimony, her hands painted black to symbolize oil.
And I think you need to be charged with a crime. You need to go to jail.
Aside from being an activist, Wilson is a fourth-generation Gulf Coast shrimper. Benjamin says she's worried she'll never be able to shrimp again, and neither will future generations in her family. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
As tens of thousands of barrels of oil continue to flow into the Gulf from BP's Deepwater Horizon well, thousands of other rigs continue production in the region, including more than 100 deepwater operations. These rigs continue operations despite President Obama's temporary ban on some drilling in the region. One of those is a massive oil rig, even larger and deeper than the one that caused the current spill. It's also operated by BP, and there is also evidence of ongoing safety violations at the site called Atlantis. A former employee turned whistleblower and consumer groups are pointing to internal BP documents and warning that an accident at the site could be far worse than the one that led to the current disaster. For more, we're joined by Winona Howder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch. That's a nonprofit consumer advocacy group based in Washington, D.C. She's attending testimony and joins us from Capitol Hill. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Much has been made about this six-month moratorium on oil drilling in the Gulf. What exactly does it ban, and what operations are permitted to continue?
Well, there are 141 deep water oil production facilities in the Gulf operating right now, and they will be able to continue to operate. There are just under 4,000 oil production facilities altogether, many of them in more shallow water, and they'll be able to continue to produce oil. So basically what the moratorium means is that new operations coming online are temporarily banned.
I see. So those that are exploring for new oil deposits or just starting production?
Right. Anything that would be coming online right now will not be able to continue to operate. They won't be able to drill. And so all of the production that's going on already, though, will continue.
Now, one of those that is continuing its operation is the deep sea production at the Atlantis rig. That's BP's Atlantis rig. Where is it and how big is its production?
Well, BP Atlantis is 150 miles off the coast of New Orleans. It's the largest semi-submergible oil production facility in the world. It is drilling 7,000 feet under the sea, and it is producing about 8.4 million gallons of oil every year.
So as you say, 7,000 feet under the sea, that's deeper than the Deepwater Horizon rig.
Yes,
that
which is
been.
About 5,000 mm-hmm. feet. Yes, it's operating in very deep water with high pressure, very difficult conditions.
Now, that rig Atlantis is also under investigation from the MMS. What's the history of this oil rig?
Well, for the last year, we've been trying to get MMS to take action on BP Atlantis. A whistleblower who has now come forward and identified himself, but who we've been working with for the last year, his name is Ken Abbott, was the documents manager for the subsea portion of BP Atlantis. And what he found when he went to work there was that 90% of the safety documentation was missing. These are the as-built drawings, the engineer-approved design specifications that make it possible for the oil production facility to operate safely. So you can imagine on a production facility like this that has millions of components, none of the safety documentation for the wellheads, the flow lines, the safety logic, none of this is in order. And so if there's an accident, really they don't know how to turn it off. And we actually saw this with the BP Horizon, where the blowout preventer had been modified by BP, but the people operating the apparatus weren't aware of this.
So compare the BP Atlantis with BP's Deep Horizon oil rig. With that explosion, that's become the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history. What are the potential dangers of this ongoing operation taking place now at Atlantis?
Well, Atlantis is a much bigger facility. There could be a much larger spill. And we believe that there's an imminent danger because the as-built, engineer-approved safety documentation is not there. And if you had a similar occurrence to what happened on the Horizon, they would not be able to quickly shut down the production at this facility. There are all sorts of different accidents that could occur because they don't know where all of the millions of components and the safety logic, how they have actually been constructed.
And quickly, you're there in D.C. attending testimony of Mr. Abbott, the former BP employee. What is he telling lawmakers?
Well, he's telling his story about how he found that 90% of the 7,000 documents, more than 6,000, were missing, and that when he went to BP management, they weren't willing to spend the extra money to get the safety documentation in order. And we're hoping that members of Congress are going to, as a result of this testimony, that there will be even more scrutiny into the BP Atlantis and the way MMS is operating.
Winona Howder, Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, thank you.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton appeared before a Senate panel to convince skeptical lawmakers about the importance of the START Treaty, the nuclear weapons agreement with Russia. As FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports, the treaty is not just about reducing the number of nuclear weapons, but also about the long-term defense strategy.
Since President Obama and Russian President Medvedev signed the new START Treaty in April, the Senate has been closely looking at it. Independent Senator Joseph Lieberman of Connecticut describes the treaty as
a small step forward for mankind, but a long way, I'm sure you'd agree, from the dream that people harbor of having a nuclear-free world.
7 years after the treaty is signed, Russia and the U.S. can have a maximum of 1,550 deployed nuclear warheads. Some have said the treaty will do little to reduce the number of nuclear weapons. Democratic Senator Roland Burris of Illinois asked Defense Secretary Robert Gates about that.
Russia will, and I quote, fulfill its pledge without eliminating a singular actual weapon. Is there any truth to this article, Secretaries?
The Russians, the number of their strategic nuclear delivery vehicles is in fact below the treaty limits, but the number of warheads is above the treaty limits. So they will have to take down warheads.
Secretary Clinton says the treaty has more to do with the U.S.'s national defense rather than the direct reduction of nuclear weapons. She cautioned against not passing the treaty, which she says is an important tactic to leverage power against U.S. adversaries.
It would very much undermine the relationship that President Obama has been leading us to establish to provide more confidence between the United States and Russia so that together we can tackle the threats posed by Iran, North Korea, and networks of terrorists.
Part of the discussion on Capitol Hill around the New START treaty has revolved around the U.S.'s nuclear arsenal. Secretary Gates says the renewal of the START treaty will help him receive money he's been seeking for years to modernize the U.S.'s nuclear weapons.
Basically, realistically, I see this treaty as a vehicle to finally be able to get what we need in the way of modernization that we have been unable to get otherwise.
The president requested an additional $80 million to update the existing nuclear weapons. Outdated technology has caused some of the supply to be unusable. Not addressed in the treaty is tactical nuclear weapons. Both the U.S. and Russia have a large supply of these more mobile weapons to be used on the battlefield. Secretary Clinton says the START treaty will be a stepping stone to discuss tactical nuclear weapons down the road.
Negotiating with the Russians on tactical nuclear weapons will be difficult, but I would underscore the importance of ratifying the New START treaty to have any chance of us beginning to have a serious negotiation over tactical nuclear weapons.
John Pfeffer is co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus. He says the START treaty will have few immediate impacts on nuclear weapons.
We won't really see any major reductions in nuclear arms. Important aspect of the treaty really is in trust building, in verification, and really setting the kind of standard to, I hope, within the next few years, move rather resolutely toward actual reductions in nuclear armaments.
The treaty still faces significant hurdles in the Senate. Some lawmakers are concerned that the treaty will reduce the U.S.'s missile defense system. Others are concerned that the intelligence community has been silent on the treaty, failing to give assurances. Russia President Medvedev is expected to meet with President Obama next week in D.C. Senate leadership hopes to ratify the treaty in the next couple of months. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
A judge in San Francisco has heard final arguments in the first federal trial over a state's ban on same-sex marriage. 18,000 lesbian and gay couples married in California after a state court allowed gay marriage, but voters later passed a ballot measure called Proposition 8 banning any new marriages for same-sex couples. Now the issue is in the hands of a federal district judge in a lawsuit that could ultimately end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Christopher Martinez files this report from San Francisco.
This case for us is about how we as Americans just want to be treated equally by our government and under the law.
Sandra Steer is a plaintiff in the lawsuit Perry v. Schwarzenegger, a challenge to the ballot initiative that declared only a man and a woman can marry in California. She spoke briefly to reporters on her way into a federal district courtroom to hear final arguments in the trial. It's a case that began more than a year ago. John Lewis is with the group Marriage Equality USA. He and his husband Stuart Gaffney were plaintiffs in the earlier state court trial that allowed same-sex marriage in California, until it was overturned at the ballot by Proposition 8. Lewis and his husband are celebrating their second wedding anniversary. They're one of the 18,000 lesbian and gay couples that legally married before voters passed Prop 8. Now Lewis is closely watching the federal trial, and he thinks that trial will be a defeat for gay marriage opponents.
At this trial, their tactics that date back from the Nita Bryant years, those tactics are being put to the test of evidence.
The evidence phase of the trial ended in January. Wednesday, lawyers for each side made their closing arguments in front of Judge Vaughn Walker. The judge opened proceedings by saying June is, after all, the month of weddings. He didn't mention that June is also Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Pride Month. Lawyer Theodore Olson presented arguments for the plaintiffs who want to overturn Prop 8. He says the trial has been a great education, referring to weeks of expert testimony and dozens of volumes of documents that make up the trial record. That record establishes the body of evidence that any higher court will rely on in appeals. Olson says Proposition 8 violates the U.S. Constitution's guarantees of equal protection and due process because it discriminates against lesbian and gay couples for no rational reason. San Francisco Deputy City Attorney Therese Stewart also argued against Prop 8, telling the judge San Francisco wants nothing more than to be able to treat all its citizens equally. During a break in the proceedings, she told reporters she was proud to be able to present San Francisco's piece of the argument.
I do think that it adds something to say that it not only hurts the individuals who are affected, but it hurts all of us when any group is stigmatized.
After a lunch break, supporters of Prop 8 made their case. Lawyer Charles Cooper said, without the marital relationship, society itself would come to an end. He told the judge the traditional definition of marriage as between a man and a woman is ubiquitous and has been in every society for millennia. Judge Walker asked Cooper to move from the millennia to the 3 weeks in January, when lawyers presented their evidence. What does the evidence show? He asked. Cooper replied, Your Honor, you don't have to have evidence. The judge, seeming surprised, asked, I don't have to have evidence? Later, Cooper told the judge, Just go back to your chamber and pull down any dictionary, and you'll find the same definition of marriage. The same goes for any book on the subject, Cooper added, unless it was written in the last 30 years. Cooper argues limiting marriage to a man and a woman furthers a state interest by channeling what he calls potentially procreative activity into a stable union, where a child is raised by his or her biological parents. Prop 8 lawyer Andrew Pugno raised that point after the last day of trial testimony in January.
The best thing for a child is to have both a mother and a father. It's a very simple proposition. And the only social relationship that can offer a mother and a father is a man and a woman.
Opponents of gay marriage point out that 7 million Californians voted for Prop 8, and they argue citizens have a right to define marriage. But the plaintiffs challenging the ban say Prop 8 is a case of a majority voting to take away a civil right from a minority. David Boies is one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs supporting gay marriage.
No vote can take away a constitutional right. That is why we have a constitution.
The trial record is now complete and the legal arguments are finished. But for Stuart Gaffney, watching the trial on his and his husband's second wedding anniversary, that was not the most important thing.
The law, of course, is going to be the foundation of a great decision, and we see that the judge is being incredibly thorough and actually looking in every nook and cranny of this case to make sure every argument is heard. But at the end of the day, it's going to come back to this is about love and marriage, and that's what we heard this morning.
Judge Vaughn Walker could rule on the case in the next few months or even the next few weeks. Whichever side loses is all but certain to appeal, and the case could end up in the U.S. Supreme Court. Christopher Martinez, FSRN, San Francisco.
And that wraps up today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Scott Pham. You can visit us online at fsrn.org. You can send questions, comments, or news tips to comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Dorian Marina.